Reform Devoted, to those of you who have come to realize that the world's religious, political, economic, and military institutions are corrupt, that they're counterproductive, I am Yada. Our number, if you'd like to join us anytime over the next 2 hours, toll free, 877-300-7645. While there is option for different assessments, some may begin to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim tonight at sunset. Others may choose to do it tomorrow night at sunset. Yesterday, I spent a good part of the program explaining the fact that there is no specificity regarding what constitutes a Kodesh moon. Yahweh never says, does the light need to be visible by a person with average eyesight from a place with a low western horizon on a relatively cloudless evening, and that renewable light has to occur before the moon sets for that to establish the first day of the month. No. He never tells us that it ought to be observed or calculated. Never specifies either. And, you know, don't make no mistake. The calculated means, the astronomical means of determining a new moon preceded the time that the Torah was revealed to us during the Exodus. You know, it just does not supply specificity. There isn't even any specificity regarding Abib, which is the first month of the year. We have deduced from the best linguistic sources available to us that Abib speaks of barley being green and growing, but, boy, there's a lot of extrapolation even there. And most of that extrapolation, green and growing and barley, is really a perspective on what Abib means based upon who Yahweh is and what he's offering. And seeing barley, which is a symbol for souls that are valued, is part of Yahweh's family. And the rest of the plant as chaff is blown away and just ceasing to exist over time. But other than that, we really don't have much specificity. You know, is the barley to be an inch above the ground level? Just a young little sprout? A foot? Is the kernel of the barley supposed to be very well developed and discernible, but still green? Or is it to be ready for harvest? No specificity. Are we to choose the renewable light on the moon immediately after whatever standard that we have deduced regarding barley, that's the new moon closest to that time? Or is it the new moon only after that time? Again, there's no instructions in this regard. So we're left with a realization that there is no specificity. You may want it. You may say, you know, Yahweh is very specific. No, he's not, actually. I mean, there's not a great deal of specificity to a huge swath of Yahweh's statements. Most of what we have deduced, we've had to deduce because there wasn't specificity by design. If there was deliberate specificity, if Yahweh said, this is the first day of the month, and it's based upon a person with, you know, average eyesight standing in this position, in this place, with this kind of a obscuring horizon, this kind of sky, seeing this much light at this time on the moon before it ducks under the horizon, and that Abib is based upon barley being exactly like such and such in such a place at such a time. Yeah, okay. But even then, when are we supposed to start the day? Sunset or sunrise? Now, I think that the creation account tells us that the sun and moon have been made as signs for the Moed. The Moed described the Mikre. It's the Moed Mikre. Pesach is the first of these Moed Mikra. Mikra being the singular, Mikre being the plural. Invitations to be called out and meet with God. Moed meeting times. And Yahweh says that the sun and the moon, the greater and lesser luminaries in the sky, became visible as signs for the Moed, for the meeting times. That means that his instructions are to use the sun and the moon. He didn't say use the moon and barley. He said use the sun and moon. So if we are to use the sun and the moon to establish the meeting times, then since the lunar cycles are known and the solar cycles are known, wouldn't we just apply the lunar cycle to the solar cycle to determine what is the best fit for the time that barley would be Abib? You know, roughly the shape that the word implies, which is green and growing, still receptive. I mean, that's what makes sense to me. But I think it's important that we are clear that Yahweh did not supply specificity. And because he did not supply specificity, anybody who tells you that it is absolutely this date, and that anybody who has any other date is in violation of some rule that Yahweh has established, I'm sorry, they're misleading you. Now, that's not to say that Yahweh doesn't care about the timing, but he has done the same thing with the timing of Pesach. I think giving us, in this particular year, the option of two different days to celebrate it, beginning tonight, Thursday night at sunset, or tomorrow night, beginning at sunset. I think that he has given us the option of two different days on many years. Sometimes it's clear and there's no question about it, but because he wants us to think through the process. He doesn't want us to be dogmatic. Dogmatic individuals become religious individuals. They don't think. They don't explore. They said, okay, that's the answer. I don't even bother to figure out what was the question and what is the basis of that answer. But Yah's whole approach is, let's figure out why things are as they are. Let's understand them. You know, it's one thing to say that, well, you know, this is the Shabbat, it's the seventh day. It's another thing to understand the process and the thoughtfulness and the basis of the Shabbat and understand what it represents. You know, what's the purpose of Passover? Understanding the purpose of Passover and capitalizing on it is vastly more important than being able to determine with accuracy, even if it were possible, whether to begin to celebrate it tonight or tomorrow night. If you're wrong by a day, if there is indeed a wrong, but you understand why you're doing it, you're a member of the covenant and you're celebrating it as the doorway to life, the doorway to Yahweh's home, and as the portal to the greater dimensions, if you will, that Yahweh exists in, then marvelous. If you're celebrating the right day, but you haven't got a clue that Passover is for those who are engaged in the covenant, and that it is the portal to greater dimensions, to the place where Yahweh is, and to his home, and to life, then it's not going to do a bit of good. Well, the Jews have made a science out of dating it, but don't understand it. Christians have made a mission out of negating it, of besmirching it, of demeaning it, of disassociating from it, so it doesn't do them any good. So I just want folks to have an appreciation for the fact that most of the things that Yahweh says, you have to think about. Yahweh does not say with great specificity, for example, that Passover is about life, and that matzah is about perfection, about vindication, or that Bukurim is about being adopted into his family. There is no statement that says those things and those words. But yet when you make the connections between everything that Yahweh has to say about these things, and when you associate them with the covenant, and recognize that they provide the benefits of the covenant, then I think the answer, the understanding becomes obvious. But it's not through specificity that one comes to these conclusions. It is about through the process of observation and contemplation. And if Yahweh wants us to think about these things, to study his testimony and to think about these things so that we come to understand them, why wouldn't he present the timing of Pesach the same way? Now, with that introduction, I do want to cover a few items in the news before we return to our presentation of the first Pesach later in the program today. The thing that I have been warning Americans in particular about made another giant leap forward. I've said for some time that I think that the triggering mechanism that will collapse the American economy and turn a tomorrow not all that far into our immediate future into a very different tomorrow than today is America losing its reserve status as an international trade currency. And currently, the dollar is the dominant player in reserve status, which is why we're able to fake being in debt and not bankrupt. The reason I mentioned the reserve status for the U.S. currency is that the only reason now that there's even any pretense of America being solvent financially is that most goods made between various countries are traded between those countries in dollars. That makes America the reserve currency. What countries then have to have dollars in their possession, which they typically have via treasuries, to underwrite, if you will, the trade of the goods that companies within their countries make or trade that companies within their countries wish to buy. And those transactions are enumerated, if you will, in dollars. Because the U.S. dollar for so long was the most reliable currency and the most freely traded currency in the world. Part of that was because America was the leading manufacturer in the world. Now, we are no longer the leading manufacturer in the world. And so trade, when people are buying things and selling things, is more likely to go to China now than it is to America. And the relative size of economies has changed so that the Eurozone, for example, is a larger economy than the U.S. economy, all under one currency, the euro. Now, if nations around the world didn't have to have possession of dollars to conduct international trade, then there would be no reason to hold dollars. There would be no reason to buy treasuries, and then America would be wholly dependent upon this illusion of quantitative easing for funding the debt, which is make-believe. That's just simply a cartel creating the illusion of money, devaluing the currency to have this illusion of money by the treasuries, which it then is establishing and charging interest on. Now, this is the news out of China. Reuters is reporting China is much closer to joining the major league of reserve currencies, with a deal possible later this year to include the yuan in the International Monetary Fund unit of account in international finance. So it's not just that China has become the world's leading manufacturer. It's not just that China has the world's fastest growing economy. It's not just that China is the best example of free enterprise in terms of economic application today. It's not just that America has gone to socialism and fascism and has destroyed its ability to manufacture goods and has now only about 8 to 9% of GDP is manufacturing. It's not only that America has created this entitlement mentality of over-robbing and over-taxing productive people to encourage the majority of Americans to be unproductive, rewarding them for being unproductive, and therefore has become the world's greatest debtor nation in human history. But because of all of this, and because of quantitative easing, where the value of the U.S. currency was hugely diluted by the Fed, countries around the world, particularly Great Britain, France, and Germany, as well as China and Russia, are scrambling to replace the dollar as the world's reserve currency. And the principal mechanism for doing this will be China, and it will be the yuan. And when that occurs, the illusion that America is solvent will be over. And the conditions for the United States will not be like that of Greece, where there is gargantuan unemployment and riots in the streets related to this, and they go out begging to the world for loans, and then say, oh, by the way, we're not going to pay off our loans because we can't pay off our loans, and for the people demanding that there's no end to their entitlements, while they go out and beg the world for more money while saying we're not going to pay you back, because with America there'll be no one to loan America money. You know, it's one thing for the world's productive economies to loan Greece tens of billions of dollars. But tens of billions of dollars does not make a dent into the tens of trillions of dollars of the U.S. debt. There is no one out there that can loan America trillions of dollars. And no one who could would. Therefore, America will go bankrupt. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We'll return to this reserve currency issue and where China is headed relative to reserve currency in a moment. We have Thomas calling in from Louisiana who has a question on Pesach Passover. Hello, Thomas.
Well, hello, Yada. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
I'm sure you're all excited for the beginning of Pesach and the beginning of the festival feast, as most of us are.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, I look at it as a happy time of celebration.
I do as well. I have my wife to thank for getting me in on this. She was searching for the truth, and she happened to stumble across you one day and started listening, and it was a great thing. We both have learned quite a bit, and we're following in Yahweh's word.
Oh, outstanding. It's, you know, when a marriage works that way, where a husband or wife is able to find who Yahweh is and what he is offering, what he's expecting from us, what he's had to say to us by way of instruction, and introduces that knowledge, that understanding to their husband or wife, in your case husband, and both journey down this this path of discovery together to Yahweh, man, that is really as good as the institution of marriage can be. I just think that is, you're a lucky man. I'm happy for you. That's a blessing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I certainly am. Certainly am. My question is about about the lamb.
Yes.
We live out in the woods, so we kind of have some freedom to ourselves. And
okay.
We were looking to actually maybe slaughter our own lamb. I have my own lamb.
Okay.
And I'm concerned. I'm not sure what practices would be best in order to actually slaughter the lamb this evening.
Wow. Okay. Well, you know, I'm the only animals that I have. You're asking someone here for advice that knows less than you probably do regarding slaughtering. I mean, all we know from Yahweh's testimony in slaughtering is that he does he wants us to cut the throat and to have the animal be hung in such a way that the blood drains out onto the ground quickly. You know, his statements are very clear on blood needs to drain out very quickly. And Yahweh does specify, you know, if you read his detailed accounts of Pesach, he does specify what part of the animal are unfit to eat. But you know, just our common understanding of you know, you don't eat the head and you don't eat the paws, the hooves, and you don't drink the blood is pretty straightforward. But other than those two things, and you know, the only thing that I ever see in terms of an animal actually butchered is our farm in Virginia. If we don't allow our farm managers and helpers to hunt on the farm, we get really abnormal looking deer, and the deer become so plentiful that they begin to starve. And so we do allow them to hunt so long as they butcher and eat themselves that which they hunt. And so I've watched them hang the carcass of the animal that they have hunted and how they skin it and then butcher it effectively, holding it on a chain and metal system that is specifically designed to hold it vertically and allow all the blood to drain out. But other than the few things I've mentioned that are mentioned in the Torah, there really isn't much by way of instruction. And that's... Now, I want to tell you, when you do that, you know, you're going to really have an appreciation for the sacrifice of the that the lamb made. You know, I will tell you, though, and this is my own interpretation. That's not necessarily so, but there is a place where Yahweh says, you know, I've had my fill of in fact, I think it's in Yashayah. I've had my fill of sacrifices and slaughtering. You know, I've had enough of it. And part of that's because, you know, he's already made the sacrifice. And so I look at Pesach as a festival feast designed to celebrate what he has done. So
yes, sir.
My interpretation, Thomas, is that as we move into the millennia, and we are still celebrating Pesach, you know, I'm not so certain that we're going to actually witness the slaughter of the lamb, because the lamb has already been slaughtered. And so I think we're just going to enjoy the meal. Now, I understand that somebody's got to slaughter the lamb for us to enjoy the meal, but you know, as I say, I see it as symbolic I don't think it was symbolic then, but I think it is symbolic now. because
yes.
we are on the other side of the sacrifice of Pesach.
Right. Well, you know, I understand the symbolism behind it.
Oh, yes.
I was concerned that there were certain ways I needed to do it in order to be as most observant without upsetting Yahweh.
Well, first of all, you're not going to upset Yahweh when you are. There is no way. It's physically impossible for you to upset Yahweh by thoughtfully trying to follow his instructions and to answer this invitation to participate in Pesach with an understanding of what it represents. Under that scenario, there is nothing you could do that would upset him. I mean, if you could figure out how to wiggle your nose and ears at the same time while eating the lamb, he'd just get a chuckle out of it. I mean, no, there's nothing you can do that's going to upset him. And you know, this may be a marvelous, permanent, you know, memory for you of, wow, I really get it in terms of Pesach. You know, it's more for you and your wife now than understanding. You really would have a vivid portrayal of the sacrifice that Yahweh made by way of Yosha's body. So I'm certainly not going to discourage it. But no, all Yahweh has to say here is that it's a slit of the throat, and the blood be allowed to drain out onto the ground, and that he does specify that there are certain parts that really are unedible, that aren't good for you. He wants you to eat the healthy parts. But
yes. Now, the other question I have is, I often tan my own hides, and I understand that you have to burn whatever remainders over the open fire.
Right.
I cannot keep the hide of the sheep, because we oftentimes use the hide with the down for different things, like, you know, sometimes I sell it for clothing. I need to go ahead and include the hide in burning the sheep. Is that correct?
Well, you know, I think in this particular case, since you are slaughtering the lamb for the specific observance of Pesach, then if you're going to go that far, I'd go all the way. You know, so yeah, I think in this particular case, I'd incinerate the rest of it in a fire. But it's only because you're trying to visually and actually do the whole thing exactly as Yahweh has laid it out. So under that case, I think if you're going to go 99% of the way, you might as well go 100% of the way. In this particular case, yeah, I would incinerate the hide and every part of it. And the rest of the year, when you slaughter an animal for food, then I would use the hide. But I mean, all we can do here, Thomas, and I think you're recognizing this. Yahweh specified the instructions for Pesach, knowing that the vast preponderance of time, would not be able to do it the way that he has instructed. The vast preponderance of us cannot bring a lamb into our home and 4 days before Passover and have the lamb live in our home. We don't live in tents. We don't live in a rural community. We don't herd sheep. We'd be in violation of all sorts of laws if we did that. It's just not possible. And you look at each of the Moed. You know, we get to Moed where there are like seven different animals on the menu.
Yes.
And there's a certain number of all of those animals on the menu, and there's nobody out there that's going to be able to comply specifically with everything Yahweh says. You're not going to be able to get, a goat, seven lambs, seven cows, and, you know, go on down the list. It's just not remotely feasible. So there's lots of things in the Torah that you just can't do,
right,
according to what is specified. And so the conclusion there, the only rational conclusion, is that it's all there to learn from, to understand from. And if you understand the symbolism of it, and you celebrate the symbolism of it and the meaning behind it, that then you are capitalizing on why the instruction is there. So, you know, in this particular case, I would say that you are in a unique position, and you've made a choice to be literal. And so if you're going to be literal, incinerate the hide.
Okay. I understand.
Yeah, but, you know, again, it's your choice here. And you and your wife have embraced Yahweh's testimony. You've come to know him. You've come to understand the covenant. You've chosen to participate in the covenant. You are answering his invitations to meet, and you're celebrating these invitations in a way that capitalizes on what the benefit is from Yahweh to you. That in and of itself, as you know, is sufficient.
Yes.
Anything that you do beyond that is to underscore and reinforce and enrich your understanding and appreciation for these things, the better.
Yes.
But, you know, it's you now have a direct line to Yahweh. And so, you know, I would do as you think he's instructing you. Yeah, just looking here quickly, there isn't a lot of specificity, again, on slaughterings. I mean, the Torah says in Devarim 12:21, you should slaughter any of the herd of your flock, which Yahweh has given to you, as I have instructed you, and you should eat it within your community. After the desire of your nefesh. And in actuality, this is a passage we spend a lot of time talking about in terms of, if you really get to the root of the words, it's, you know, he is telling us that, that those who are thoughtful and wants us to engage in thoughtfulness regarding what we eat is the basis of this particular passage, and then what it ultimately leads to. So there is from that, however, in the nature of the Talmud and the Mishnah, the rabbis have come up with a whole narrative on what is considered kosher slaughtering versus not kosher slaughtering. You know, they get to means that the neck needs to be cut with a swift, smooth cut of a sharp knife whose blade is free of any dent or imperfection. And they go on to talk about the oral interpretations of it. But the very fact that they're going into that kind of approach where they have their Talmud oral variations, interpretations, additions, says that there isn't great specificity from Yahweh in the matter. Hello, Glenn. I understand you want to turn back to the yuan and international currency and reserve currencies.
Well, yeah. First, I want to know, is it okay if the mint jelly is artificially colored?
You know, I think that, we'll absolutely have a tizzy fit if you use artificially colored mint jelly. Yeah.
Okay. I'll go with the organic stuff.
Yeah. We're being facetious, obviously, here, but, you know, unless the mint jelly is made by a process of yeast, I think you're okay. But you know what's interesting, of course, is that Yosha drank wine in celebration of Pesach and told us that when we drink wine as part of the Pesach celebration, and my guess is that we can take Yosha's observance of Pesach as being a valid way to celebrate it. And he celebrated it by drinking wine in addition to eating unyeasted bread and lamb. And you know how the reason I've been just joking about this and the yeast is, you know how wine is made.
Right. Yeah, we had talked about this the other week. The yeast eats the sugars and excretes the alcohol. So, well, one yeast's urine is another man's alcohol.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly right. Which means that the yeast that we're talking about is live yeast, and as a source of baking aerated bread, and yeast that has been used and bread that has been baked with yeast in it would be the only thing we're talking about in terms of matzah. Yawa is not talking about yeast that would be used in to make beer and wine. The symbolism is the yeast to make aerated bread, and aerated bread that has been baked with yeast. And it's limited to that. You know, to go any further than that, we're extrapolating. And you know, if you want to extrapolate, that's your call. It's just that you don't have specificity. That's the word of the day: is specificity.
I always thought it was interesting that the amount of alcohol in wine is of course limited because of the fermentation is a self-terminating process because the yeast eventually die when the environment becomes too toxic. So that's
correct. Isn't it? Is it 12%? Isn't that the?
I think it's even less. I think because I know that in modern wine they add, I believe they add sugar or something to increase the. The amount of fermentation that can take place or something like that.
But, you know, it's interesting,
of
course.
Economic thing after the break.
Okay, you know what's interesting too about wine and beer is that by having the alcohol makes the water that comprises the preponderance of wine and beer safe to drink. Without the alcohol, the water in the wine and beer, or just water in general, would not be safe to drink. So the alcohol is actually something that makes it safe.